Chapter 21. I am going to, this time, apostrophe said Swithin, and turned the chat to other matters. XXIII, Swithin could not sleep that night for thinking of his Viviette. Nothing told so significantly of the conduct of her first husband towards the poor lady as the abiding dread of him which was revealed in her by any sudden revival of his image or memory. But for that consideration her almost childlike terror at Swithin's inadvertent disguise would have been ludicrous. He waited anxiously through several following days for an opportunity of seeing her, but none was afforded. Her brother's presence in the house sufficiently accounted for this. At length he ventured to write a note, requesting her to signal to him in a way as he had done once or twice before, by pulling down a blind in a particular window of the house, one of the few visible from the top of the Rings Hill column, this to be done on any evening, when she could see him after dinner on the terrace. When he had leveled the glass at that window for five successive nights he beheld the blind in the position suggested. 3 hours later, quite in the dusk, he repaired to the place of appointment. My brother is away this evening, apostrophe she explained, and that's why I can come out. He is only gone for a few hours, nor is he likely to go for longer just yet. He keeps himself a good deal in my company, which has made it unsafe for me to venture near you. Apostrophe apostrophe, has he any suspicion? Apostrophe apostrophe, none, apparently. But he rather depresses me. Apostrophe, how, Viviette? Apostrophe apostrophe, Swithin feared, from her manner, that this was something serious. I would rather not tell. Apostrophe apostrophe, but well, never mind. Apostrophe apostrophe, yes, Swithin, I will tell you. There should be no secrets between us. He urges upon me the necessity of marrying, day after day. Apostrophe, for money and position, of course. Apostrophe apostrophe, yes. But I take no notice. I let him go on. Apostrophe, really, this is sad. Apostrophe apostrophe, said the young man. I must work harder than ever, or you will never be able to own me. Apostrophe apostrophe, oh yes, in good time. Apostrophe apostrophe, she cheeringly replied. I shall be very glad to have you always near me. I felt the gloom of our position keenly, when I was obliged to disappear that night, without assuring you, it was only I who stood there. Why were you so frightened at those old clothes I borrowed? Apostrophe apostrophe, don't ask, don't ask. Apostrophe apostrophe, she said, burying her face on his shoulder. I don't want to speak of that. There was something so ghastly, and so uncanny in your putting on such garments, that I wish you had been more thoughtful, and had left them alone. Apostrophe apostrophe, he assured her, that he did not stop to consider whose they were. By the way, they must be sent back, apostrophe he said. No, I never wish to see them again. I cannot help feeling that your putting them on was ominous. Apostrophe apostrophe, nothing is ominous in serene philosophy, apostrophe he said, kissing her. Things are either causes, or they are not causes. When can you see me again? Apostrophe apostrophe, in such wise the hour passed away. The evening was typical of others which followed it at irregular intervals through the winter. And during the intenser months of the season frequent falls of snow lengthened, even more than other difficulties had done, the periods of isolation between the pair. Swithin adhered with all the more strictness to the letter of his promise, not to intrude into the house, from his sense of her powerlessness, to compel him to keep out should he choose to rebel. A student of the greatest forces in nature, he had, like many others of his sort, no personal force to speak of in a social point of view, mainly because he took no interest in human ranks and formulas, and hence he was as docile as a child in her hands, wherever matters of that kind were concerned. Her brother wintered at Welland, but whether because his experience of tropic climes had unfitted him for the brumal rigors of Britain, or for some other reason, he seldom showed himself out of doors, and Swithin caught, but passing glimpses of him. Now and then Viviette's impulsive affection would overcome her sense of risk, and she would press Swithin to call on her at all costs. This he would by no means do. It was obvious to his more logical mind that the secrecy to which they had bound themselves must be kept in its fullness, or might as well be abandoned altogether. He was now sadly exercised on the subject of his uncle's will. There had as yet been no pressing reasons for a full and candid reply to the solicitor who had communicated with him, owing to the fact that the payments were not to begin till Swithin was 21. But time was going on, and something definite would have to be done soon. To own to his marriage and consequent disqualification for the bequest was easy in itself, but it involved telling at least one man what both Viviette and himself had great reluctance in telling anybody. Moreover, he wished Viviette to know nothing of his loss in making her his wife. All he could think of doing for the present was to write a postponing letter to his uncle's lawyer, and wait events. The one comfort of this dreary winter time was his perception of a returning ability to work with the regularity and much of the spirit of earlier days. One bright night in April there was an eclipse of the moon, and Mr. Torkingham, by arrangement, brought to the observatory several laboring men and boys, to whom he had promised a sight of the phenomenon through the telescope. The coming confirmation, fixed for May, was again talked of, and St. Cleeve learned from the parson that the bishop had arranged to stay the night at the vicarage, and was to be invited to a grand luncheon at Welland House immediately after the ordinance. This seemed like a going back into life again as regarded the mistress of that house, and St. Cleeve was a little surprised that, in his communications with Viviette, as he had mentioned no such probability. The next day he walked round the mansion, wondering how in its present state any entertainment could be given there. He found that the shutters had been opened, which had restored an unexpected liveliness to the aspect of the windows. Two men were putting a chimney pot on one of the chimney stacks, and two more were scraping green mold from the front wall. He made no inquiries on that occasion. 3 days later he strolled thitherward again. Now a great cleaning of window panes was going on, Hezzy Biles and Sammy Bloor being the operators, for which purpose their services must have been borrowed from the neighboring farmer. Hezzy dashed water at the glass with a force that threatened to break it in, the broad face of Sammy being discernible inside, smiling at the onset. In addition to these, Anthony Green and another were weeding the gravel walks and putting fresh plants into the flower beds. Neither of these reasonable operations was a great undertaking, singly looked at, but the life Viviette had latterly led, and the mood in which as he had hitherto regarded the premises, rendered it somewhat significant. Swithin, however, was rather curious than concerned at the proceedings, and returned to his tower with feelings of interest not entirely confined to the world's overhead. Lady Constantine may or may not have seen him from the house, but the same evening, which was fine and dry, while he was occupying himself in the observatory with cleaning the eyepieces of the equatorial, skull cap on head, observing jacket on, and in other ways primed for sweeping, the customary stealthy step on the winding staircase brought her form in due course into the rays of the bullseye lantern. The meeting was all the more pleasant to him from being unexpected, and he at once lit up a larger lamp in honor of the occasion. "It is but a hasty visit," apostrophe she said when, after putting up her mouth to be kissed, as he had seated herself in the low chair used for observations, panting a little with the labor of assent. "But I hope to be able to come more freely soon. My brother is still living on with me." "Yes. He is going to stay until the confirmation is over. After the confirmation he will certainly leave. So good it is of you, dear, to please me by agreeing to the ceremony. The bishop, you know, is going to lunch with us. It is a wonder he has promised to come, for he is a man averse to society, and mostly keeps entirely with the clergy on these confirmation tours, or circuits, or whatever they call them. But Mr. Torkingham's house is so very small, and mine is so close at hand, that this arrangement to relieve him of the fuss of one meal, at least, naturally suggested itself, and the bishop has fallen in with it very readily. How are you getting on with your observations? Have you not wanted me dreadfully to write down notes? ... Well, I have been obliged to do without you, whether or no. See here, how much I have done. ... And he showed her a book ruled in columns, headed object, right ascension, declination, features, remarks, and so on. She looked over this and other things, but her mind speedily winged its way back to the confirmation. It is so new to me, she said, to have persons coming to the house, that I feel rather anxious. I hope the luncheon will be a success. ... You know the bishop? ... said Swithin. I have not seen him for many years. I knew him when I was quite a girl, and he held the little living of Puddle Sub Mixon, near us. But after that time, and ever since I have lived here, I have seen nothing of him. There has been no confirmation in this village, they say, for 20 years. The other bishop used to make the young men and women go to Warburn. He wouldn't take the trouble to come to such an out-of-the-way parish as ours. This cleaning and preparation that I observe going on must be rather a tax upon you. My brother Louis sees to it, and, what is more, bears the expense. Your brother? Said Swithin, with surprise. Well, he insisted on doing so, she replied, in a hesitating, despondent tone. He has been active in the whole matter, and was the first to suggest the invitation. I should not have thought of it. Well, I will hold aloof till it is all over. Thanks, dearest, for your considerateness. I wish it was not still advisable. But I shall see you on the day, and watch my own philosopher all through the service from the corner of my pew. I hope you are well prepared for the rite, Swithin. She added, turning tenderly to him. It would perhaps be advisable for you to give up this astronomy till the confirmation is over, in order to devote your attention exclusively to that more serious matter. More serious. Well, I will do the best I can. I am sorry to see that you are less interested in astronomy than you used to be, Viviette. No. It is only that these preparations for the bishop unsettle my mind from study. Now put on your other coat and hat, and come with me a little way. The morning of the confirmation was come. It was mid-May time, bringing with it weather not, perhaps, quite so blooming as that assumed to be natural to the month by the joyous poets of 300 years ago. But a very tolerable, well-wearing May, that the average rustic would willingly have compounded for in lieu of May's occasionally fairer, but usually more foul. Among the larger shrubs and flowers which composed the outworks of the Welland Gardens, the lilac, the laburnum, and the guelder rose hung out their respective colors of purple, yellow, and white, whilst within these, belted round from every disturbing gale, rose the columban, the peony, the larkspur, and the Solomon seal. The animate things that moved amid this scene of color were plodding bees, gadding butterflies, and numerous sauntering young feminine candidates for the impending confirmation, who, having gaily bedecked themselves for the ceremony, were enjoying their own appearance by walking about in twos and threes till it was time to start. Swithin St. Cleeve, whose preparations were somewhat simpler than those of the village bells, waited till his grandmother and Hannah had set out, and then, locking the door, followed towards the distant church. On reaching the churchyard gate, he met Mr. Torkingham, who shook hands with him in the manner of a man with several irons in the fire, and telling Swithin where to sit, disappeared to hunt up some candidates who had not yet made themselves visible. K. casting his eyes round for Viviette, and seeing nothing of her, Swithin went onto the church porch, and looked in. From the north side of the nave, smiled a host of girls, gaily uniform in dress, age, and a temporary repression of their natural tendency to skip like a hare over the meshes of good counsel. Their white muslin dresses, their round white caps, from beneath whose borders hair knots and curls of various shades of brown escaped upon their low shoulders, as if against their will, lighted up the dark pews and gray stonework to an unwonted warmth and life. On the south side were the young men and boys, heavy, angular, and massive, as indeed was rather necessary, considering what they would have to bear at the hands of wind and weather, before they returned to that moldy nave for the last time. Over the heads of all these he could see into the chancel to the square pew on the north side, which was attached to Welland House. There he discerned Lady Constantine already arrived, her brother Louis sitting by her side. Swithin entered and seated himself at the end of a bench, and she, who had been on the watch, at once showed by subtle signs her consciousness of the presence of the young man who had reversed the ordained sequence of the church services on her account. She appeared in black attire, though not strictly in mourning, a touch of red in her bonnet setting off the richness of her complexion without making her gay. Handsomest woman in the church she decidedly was, and yet a disinterested spectator who had known all the circumstances would probably have felt that, the future considered, Swithin's more natural mate would have been one of the muslin-clad maidens who were to be presented to the bishop with him that day. When the bishop had arrived and gone into the chancel, and blown his nose, the congregation were sufficiently impressed by his presence to leave off looking at one another. The Right Reverend Cuthbert Helmsdale, D.D., 94th occupant of the episcopal throne of the diocese, revealed himself to be a personage of dark complexion, whose darkness was thrown still further into prominence by the long protuberances that now rose upon his two shoulders like the eastern and western hemispheres. In Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.